You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 8th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys. How you all doing tonight?
Got a small crew tonight. Perry is still in the hospital, although he is doing better, and still vows to join us for the quote at the end of the show.
Oh, good.
Is he going to sing it again?
He promises not to sing it this time.
Steve, what was all with right. the singing last week? Did we get an answer on that?
No definitive answer. He does remember the episode, though. He does have a memory of it.
God. Well, that's good, I guess.
I think it was just being goofy. Rebecca is off this evening as well, so it's just the four guys. We have a lot of news items this evening. No guest, so we'll get caught up on some news items and emails. We do, of course, have another installment of Randy Speaks, so that'll be coming up later in the show. But first news item, astronomers have announced that they have discovered the largest known planet so far. The planet is dubbed TRES-4, T-R-E-S-4. It's the fourth planet discovered by that team. The team goes by astronomers that goes by the acronym TRES. One of the astronomers, Georgi Mandashev from the Lowell Observatory, was the lead author on the paper announcing its discovery. The planet is about 70% bigger than Jupiter.
Wow.
But it has a very low density. Its density is only about 0.2 grams per cubic centimeter, which is about the density of balsa wood. So the planet is described as being extremely fluffy.
I wasn't aware of this, but this article I read said that it belongs to a small subclass of planets called puffy planets. I don't know if that's the term that they throw around a lot, but they're calling it a subclass of puffy planets that have extremely low density, less than Saturn, which was, I think, the lowest density planet we had.
That's right.
Up until this planet was discovered, and people always say, astronomers always say that if you could find, you know, an ocean big enough, it would actually float because it's less dense than water, and this would actually is even less dense than that.
Yeah, and they're not really sure how such huge planets can be such low density. You know, why isn't the gravity making this planet more dense?
Well, Steve, what's it made out of?
It's mostly hydrogen. Yeah, it's mostly gas. There may not be any solid surface, you know, beneath the gas. So it is a gas giant like Jupiter.
Yeah, and it is quite a theoretical problem. Study team member Edward Dunham said that TRES-4 appears to be something of a theoretical problem. And another study leader, Georgi Mandashev, said that it's theoretically not even should not be able to exist.
Yeah, which is cool. It means there's something cool going on that we don't know about, which is always interesting.
So are they saying that gravity should not be having the effect that it's having on the elements of this planet?
Something is puffing the planet out, you know, is opposing the inward pull of gravity to make it fluffier than we would think it should be. So there's some other force at work or some other factor operating.
That's a very strange word to use to describe a planet, though.
For a gas giant, puffy sounds appropriate to me.
Yeah. And in fact, the outer layers of the clouds are probably wisping away. You know, they're not tightly held by the planet.
I don't know.
The planet, well, that's what they said, that it might have like a comet-like tail.
Oh, okay. You'd think the gravity would still be gargantuan.
Some other stats on the planet out of interest. It's about 4.5 million miles from its home star, which is very close, and therefore it's extremely hot. It's 1,600 degrees Kelvin or 2,300 degrees Fahrenheit. That's very, very
Yikes.
Hot.
Yeah.
And this was discovered using a method of surveying stars for transiting objects. By definition, a transit is when a planet passes in front of a star, so between the Earth and the star. It therefore obscures a little bit of the light. And you know, if we observe multiple stars over several months and we look to see if there's a dip in the light output from the star, that's how TRES-4 was discovered. Then once they see, from a larger field survey, they see that there's a star with a dip in the brightness that may be a transit. Then they'll use, you know, more powerful telescopes and zoom in on it and try to confirm that there was, in fact, a planet there. And, of course, you know, big planets close to their host stars are the easiest ones to find. So again, it's not a surprise that we're finding planets like this. It makes you wonder what's the theoretical upper limit. I mean, what's the biggest planet that could exist, you know, before whatever, and still hold on to its gas and not have it escape? Or, of course, the ultimate limit is when it gets too big, it'll collapse into a sun. You know, there'll be enough heat and pressure for the hydrogen to start fusing.
Or these kinds of planets like suns that didn't quite make it?
They're often referred to as failed stars. Steve, I seem to remember a figure reading about Jupiter and what kind of mass it would take for Jupiter for fusion to start, and I was kind of surprised at how much Jupiter would need, about 80 times its mass, in order to be considered one of the smallest types of stars.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the smallest stars, you know, known or possible, I think even theoretically, have somewhere like 80 or so Jupiter masses. Yeah, so this planet, TRESS-4, is 70% bigger than Jupiter, but it has less mass than Jupiter.
So it's considerably more puffy than Jupiter.
Right, so it's considerably more puffy, that's right. But even farther away from becoming a sun. So interesting, you know, I really enjoy seeing these new planet discoveries come in. And it's interesting that, you know, even though we've only discovered, whatever, over 200 or so planets, we're still discovering planets that are superlative in some way, the biggest, the hottest, the whatever. It's still coming in. So clearly with the sampling that we have, the possibilities for different kinds of planets out there are still greater than what we've already seen. The next news item is a follow-up of the Da Vinci Code nonsense.
This was interesting.
Well, I don't know how interesting it is. This is an Italian amateur scholar, Silvisa Pesci.
An information technologist.
Yeah, he's an information technologist by day, an amateur scholar by night. So he took a picture of Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper. And he took a mirror image. He superimposed, like made. He took a mirror image of the picture and then superimposed them over each other, partially translucent. And then when he does that, he thinks that he sees behind Jesus and to the left, his right, you know, the viewer's left, the figure of a woman holding a baby. And this is supposed to. He claims that this was deliberate, that this was done by Da Vinci in order to embed this hidden secret picture in The Last Supper, and that it must have some purposeful meaning.
Well, it's a little more involved than that, though, Steve. It's not just the image of a woman or somebody holding a baby. There's multiple images. He says that this process reveals a chalice in front of the seat of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a good image of that, and you know, it's the whole pareidolia thing coming in. I mean, it's got a somewhat chalice-like shape to it, but I really wouldn't say that's, wow, look at that. That's definitely a chalice.
Yeah, I don't see it.
There's also an image of a Knight Templar. They claim at the right end, I guess at both ends of the table. But again, that one was, you know, what does a knight of Templar look like? I did a lot of Google searching for them, and they, you know, the images that we're shown here don't necessarily coincide with a lot of the images that I came across. So why a Knight Templar? Maybe because that's what was written in the Da Vinci Code books that was, you know, riddled with the. With these mm-hmm. Templar knights, so maybe that's why they use that term. I'm not sure. I'm seeing the connection there. There's supposed to be a self-portrait of Da Vinci. Also, if you take one of the seated characters, one of the seated figures, if you kind of put the superimposed picture not over it, but kind of left to right in the middle, you see it. It's definitely a face. It looks like a face, but then of course pareidolia comes in again. And that could just be totally a coincidence. Or, you know, what I found interesting about it is I could totally see Da Vinci doing this on purpose to some degree. And this guy does say that some of the details you can infer that we're not talking about chance, but about precise calculation. Well, I'd like to see exactly what he's talking about. Which details is he referring to?
Yeah, I don't buy that at all.
That tells him this is a precise calculation.
Yeah, I always find those arguments to be very humorous. It's a clear case in that argument that there's precise, you know, aspects of this that rule out chance.
Right.
That's post hoc rationalization, and we see that all the time. Basically, what it is, you know, there you use open-ended criteria. In other words, there's no criteria that you could set ahead of time to say this is what we would expect to see if this were whatever, if this were deliberate superimposition in this case. And then you meet some gold standard or some a priori predetermined criteria that you derive because it makes sense. Instead, what they do is look for coincidences, look for anomalies, and then they declare after the fact, aha, this proves that it's genuine, this quirky aspect of it. The same exact arguments were used to argue that the face on Mars was an artifact, making
right
measurements about the symmetry of the face and various things to say, look, there's no way it could be this symmetrical. But again, it's just all post hoc analysis.
Yeah. Have you heard about, if you fold the $20 bill certain ways, it gives you clues that 9/11 was about to happen or something to that?
It's all the same thing.
That's kind of what I think about when I see something like this.
I mean, honestly, it would be if you did this, if you superimpose the paintings one over the mirror images one over the other, if you couldn't see some images that you could imagine, might be something, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
That would be incredible if you couldn't hallucinate anything.
I find it hard to believe that Da Vinci would actually do that kind of thing, too. Like, did he think in the future were going to be able to take the image and superimpose it like we can do today? I mean, he probably had no idea.
If he had a history of doing this or some precedent that he's done this before, then maybe you can attribute something to it. But
well, his backward writing, it doesn't surprise me that he potentially could have done something like that.
Yeah, it's not totally implausible because you could, I think, create the same effect by putting like a glass in front of it so that it's like partly reflecting it and partly passing the image through. You can sort of create this effect without computers, just with like mirrors and glass or whatever. So it's not totally impossible. But there's no reason to think that he did it either. I think that Da Vinci, being, as clever as he was, if he were going to do something like this, it would be more impressive. There would be something a little bit more clear cut. And then just these vague, foggy, possible images that you really got to use your imagination to see.
Do you think that the image is even clear enough to infer that this ghosted figure is holding a baby? I mean, how good is the image in now after they've restored it?
I don't at all.
No. And I don't see a baby. I mean, I can kind of see some smudges that you can – again, pareidolia comes into play your brain sort of imposes a little bit of a face like a baby-like image on it, but there's no clear-cut.
So what are they implying, that if it is a baby and not some other item or thing, are they saying that it's Jesus's baby with...
Actually, I've not read any specific speculation on what the meaning of this is.
Well, Pesci was very careful not to make any suggestion that it could be Christ's child. I put that in Pesci's favor. I like the fact that he wasn't saying, I found Jesus' baby. That, I mean, what he's doing is one thing, but the fact that he didn't totally sensationalize it, of course people are jumping on that possibility, but I don't think he specifically ever suggested it. But let me throw in a quick art expert debunking here. This guy, John Paoletti, is a professor of art history at Wesleyan University. He said there was some fairly fancy computer work being done, and you can make computer-generated images do what you want them to do. So he said that.
So this is worthless. As science, it's not probative at all. It's just, again, it really is just, pareidolia and a little bit of shoddy logic.
Is that your official skeptical stamp, Steve?
That's my opinion, yes.
This myth is busted. Boom.
The next news item is a story of a man waking from a coma. These are always interesting stories. It's the man bites dog type of story. When people don't wake from a coma, it's not news. When people do wake from a coma, it is. And it does sometimes cause a little bit of confusion and mischief when trying to counsel families about how to approach people who are in a comatose state. I blogged about this earlier in the week, or actually last week. This is more interesting because it wasn't a spontaneous recovery. This was a new treatment. What they did, this was a research team led by Dr. Nicholas Schiff. And what they did was they implanted a deep brain stimulator, which produces electrical current in the thalamus and through the thalamus to the cortex. And this was of a patient who was in what's called a minimally conscious state. So this is a very, very light form of coma. Not all comas are created equal. You could be just shy of brain death, and that's a coma. Or you could be just unable to maintain consciousness, and that's also a coma, and there's everything in between.
What a nightmare. Jeez. You imagine?
Yeah, I know. This guy's in a minimally conscious state, which means you have to be able to do something. You have to be able to respond in some way to stimulation or to or in the environment.
And which he did.
Which he was able to do beforehand, before the treatment, was able to sometimes look or turn to a person. He wasn't able to speak, however, wasn't able to feed himself. After the stimulator was put into his brain, he had some immediate benefit. He started to be more alert, more interactive. And then over the last 2 years, he has actually started to speak somewhat. He can express very simple things. He's able to eat now, so he no longer needs a feeding tube.
What progress have they made with other patients in 2 years? That seems like a long time.
I think so far this is the only one. This is the only patient.
Why would they wait?
Well, I think you need suitable candidates. You know, you need to see how this is going. It's not easy. It takes a long time to do things on a research protocol. You know, you can't just do it willy-nilly. So this is not a home run, right? This is not somebody who went from a coma to anything resembling a normal life. This guy was barely comatose, and now he's barely not comatose.
So does that even count? I mean,
well, but it's an improvement. It's a palpable,
absolutely
definite improvement. You know, certainly being able to eat, not having a feeding tube, that's nice. Being able to say simple phrases and express your feelings to people is huge. I mean, you guys,
it's a double. It's a double, at least.
Impaired. Yeah, it's not a home run. Maybe it's a double,
but the ground rule double.
The what's really interesting is that this may be the first baby step down a path that will lead to much more significant gains in
robot brains.
Yeah, I mean, so you think about the potential here. One thing, just for background, and this is just an interesting bit of neurophysiology, is that our cortex, the thinking part of our brain, is not conscious by itself. It's really interesting. It has to be constantly prodded by the brainstem. The brainstem through the thalamus is constantly barraging our cortex with signals, basically alerting it and activating it. In fact, it's called the brainstem activating system. And if that brainstem activating system isn't working, you're asleep, and if it's permanent, you know, then you're comatose, right? So,
Steve, the whole, like, Steven Seagal, you know, in a coma for 10 years and comes out and practices real hard and gets back up to his chops, that never happens.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Oh, it happened in the movie.
Yeah.
He's got no muscle left. His muscle's wasted to nothing.
But even that, I mean, if you have enough brain damage that you are in a coma for years, you don't bounce back from that to fully function.
Isn't that funny? I think a lot of people.
Yeah. Uma Thurman in that movie.
Uma Thurman in Kill Bill.
She wound up waking up 10 minutes later and driving.
I think
a car.
A lot of people have it in their head, probably from TV and movies, that people do wake up from comas and come back to a normal life. There's always like the people waiting for them to wake up and all that, but I guess that's not the case.
Yeah, I think it creates this image, which is a myth, which is not true, that somebody could be quote-unquote in a coma and that they're still in there, that their brains are somehow intact, but just it's being kept from functioning in some way. And then when they wake up from the coma, they could wake up into their normal selves. Now, that can happen over the very short period of time. You could certainly have something acute and reversible that's keeping the brain from working, you know, a drug overdose or
medically induced comas.
You know, yeah, medications obviously can do that. That's what basically anesthesia is, right? When you have surgery, it's a pharmacologically induced coma that is
could be
rapidly reversible. So yeah, there are some, you know, metabolic or physiological things that could make somebody unconscious for a period of time that is reversible. But if you're that way because of brain damage, you're not going to bounce back from that. But here's one exception, and that is if your coma is caused entirely by brainstem damage and your cortices are intact, the thinking part of your brain is intact, that potentially could be reversible because you just need to basically replace that brainstem activating system somehow.
That's all.
And then the cortex is in a coma waiting to be awakened or activated.
But you're still suffering from muscle atrophy and things like that, right, Steve?
Well, if you've been in a coma for a long time, yes. You're going to have the debility that results from being, you know, bedridden for a long period of time. Absolutely.
Steve, you said replace it with something else. What do you mean?
Like a computer chip in your head or a deep brain stimulator that can replace the constant barrage of activation signals from the brainstem. That's theoretically possible, and I think this is a little baby step in that direction. And it's also interesting to speculate about other types of treatments that could potentially reverse coma. And I think the two types of treatments that have the most promise, you know, one is computer chips that replace brain function. The other is stem cells, you know, where you can actually have new brain cells form and take up shop and make connections.
The third is time travel.
Time travel.
I just wanted to mention the atrophy. I'm not sure how commonly known this is, but when you're bedridden for a certain period of time, it's not that your muscles just shrink and get flabby. The muscle tissue actually disappears after a while, and eventually there's nothing. If you woke up and your brain turned on and your mind was perfectly agile as it was earlier, you would basically be still bedridden for forever because your muscle is actually gone. Isn't that correct, Steve?
Well, not entirely. I mean, what you're talking about is disuse atrophy, and disuse atrophy after a very long period of time could be very severe, but it's not as complete as what you're saying.
Okay.
It is not complete. What you're describing, Bob, is atrophy that results from what we call a lower motor neuron injury.
Oh, okay.
If the lower motor neuron, which is a neuron that sits in your spinal cord and sends its axon, you know, its nerve to the muscle, if that's destroyed and the muscle is getting no connection from a neuron, then after about 12 to 18 months, those muscle fibers that do not have nerve supply will die and are gone completely. So that's irrecoverable without like stem cell replacement. But disuse atrophy never gets that bad. There's always some muscle left. Probably what's worse is you get contractures. Your joints and your ligaments just freeze up, and that's very bad. You have to do passive range of motion movements to keep that from happening. And that's hard to do for years, you know, when somebody who's comatose just laying in bed. But if they do have any, you know, prospect of waking up in the future, it's important to do that kind of physical therapy to maintain, you know, their joints and ligaments.
I think Christopher Reeves was having that kind of physical therapy, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, Christopher Reeves was doing everything. I mean, he was, you know,
electrical stimulation and all sorts of stuff. And I remember reading that apparently they were doing surprisingly well. But I remember, Steve, you disagreed with that, as of now, there really wasn't a lot you can do to stave that off 100%.
That's correct. He had the lower motor neuron damage. He had the spinal cord damage, which causes actually both upper and lower motor neuron types of damage. But he did have the disuse atrophy, of course, and he was staving off, I think, the disuse atrophy and any kind of contractures by just, you know, really aggressive physical therapy. And he was using electrical stimulation to try to stave off the denervation atrophy, the lower motor neuron atrophy. And, you know, I haven't seen any compelling evidence that in fact happens. That was an interesting idea for a long time, but it turns out it's probably more the hormones that the nerves secrete onto the muscles that are necessary for their survival and not just the electrical stimulation. Well, let's move on to our next news item. Actually, we have two more news items. These are just quick follow-ups to previous stories. The first has to do with the Korean stem cell researcher, Woo-Suk Hwang. How can you say that name?
Talk about change your name.
It doesn't mean that where he's from.
I know. Some names have unfortunate translations in other
but
languages.
But that one is exceptionally strong. I mean, that's...
Maybe he shouldn't have gone on to international fame through
Imagine
his
Imagine you
shame.
Find out that your name basically means, like, something horrible in another language. Of course, I could throw in a lot of ideas here, but...
That reminds me of that movie, Alien Nation. Do you guys see that, where the cop's name was Sykes?
Yeah.
Which, in the alien language, meant excrement and cranium.
Shithead. I was just thinking of that, Steve.
Anyway, all that aside, it turns out, ironically, that his lab actually made some significant breakthroughs that were overshadowed and neglected by the fraudulent claims that were made by him and his lab. It turns out that it's now been confirmed that some of the stem cell lines that were created were the product of parthenogenesis, which is when an unfertilized egg essentially fertilizes itself. You know, a single cell becomes a stem cell or a progenitor cell.
Was he aware of this?
I don't know. I couldn't find, you know, I couldn't find any comment from him on this. I don't know that anyone's spoken to him about it.
It makes me think that he might not have been aware of it because, I mean, he's got a little mini breakthrough here and he's like, no, that's not big enough. Let's go with the grand fake breakthrough instead of this little guy.
Right, but researchers are saying, like Kent Vrana, who's an expert on parthenogenesis at Penn State University, is quoted as saying, it could have been a seminal finding if they hadn't had their blinders on. So he thinks that they just were not really aware of how either of having done this or how important it was. One of the things that some of the articles talk about is the fact that if you can make essentially an embryonic stem cell with through parthenogenesis, then you at no point do you have a fertilized embryo, and that therefore that can sidestep some of the ethical problems that people have with it. Yet another way. I mean, you know,
yet another way. How many times have we said that?
Yeah, we've talked about other ways in which the whole embryonic stem cell ethical concerns can be gotten around. This might be another one. So it's good that that discovery was not lost, you know, to the scientific community, that it was rescued essentially.
Yeah, it's
by
good
the
that they continued to look into it. That is very fortunate.
Right. How more tragic would it have been if it was lost? It's like finding something interesting in the Piltdown Man skull, you know, like, whoa.
One more quick follow-up. This 2 weeks ago, we talked about the UK UFO sighting, which was like 5 points of light floating in the sky for an hour or so, and some said was a formation. At the time, if you recall, you know, Bob, you mentioned that some of the UK skeptics speculated that it might have been lanterns released from a nearby event. Mm-hmm. And I believe you guys did not think that that was really a viable explanation.
I definitely didn't. I thought that was ridiculous sounding to me.
I really wasn't picturing the type of lanterns that they actually were, and they really didn't go into that much detail what kind of lanterns these things were. It just didn't sound right to me. But when I saw a picture of them, I was like, oh, yeah, that's possible.
Yeah, and my point at the time was, well, you know, sometimes really unusual or bizarre things can happen, like floating lanterns, and if you're not aware of them, and you won't be able to really explain an unusual sighting. It still doesn't mean it's an alien spacecraft. Well, in the last, you know, since that episode, in the last couple of weeks, it's been revealed that, in fact, those lights were giant floating Chinese lanterns released from a wedding nearby.
Well, how do they know? See, what nailed it? What was like, oh, yeah?
Because they found out that you know, those five, you know, large lanterns at that time, at that place, were released by nearby by a wedding celebration at the Bushy Police Club. And this was confirmed by the British UFO Research Organization. So they said, yep, that's the explanation.
Really?
Yeah, if you look at the picture on the news article that we linked to, you could see a representative picture of a large, you know, I think they're paper lantern with a flame underneath it. So it's like a little mini hot air balloon, really.
Right.
And the flame, of course, produces inside the lantern produces the diffuse glowing light. One other interesting point, actually, I thought that the reports that they were flying in formation was just imposing a formation onto what could have been a random assortment of these dots.
But wind currents?
I still think that could be the case. However, they brought up the point that sometimes these lanterns are tied together, and that could make them float in formation.
So did the people that lit those lanterns say any got away, or that they did indeed tie them together or anything like that?
I didn't hear that there was that confirmation that they were these specific ones were tied together, just that is commonly done, and therefore that's a common trait of this type of this class of UFO sighting, the Chinese lantern, which now has to be added to our list of possible explanations, that sometimes they're floating in formation because they are tied together.
Well, I got that one totally wrong.
Yeah, I mean it's again, the big point being the inability to explain things still doesn't mean that there isn't some either just unknown or unusual but still prosaic explanation out there. Well, let's move on to your emails and questions.
Oh, hi. Oh, boy. This is Saul. Saul Rosenberg. Hi. I really did it good this time. Oh, boy. I forgot to listen to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And my shoes fell off. Hi. And I think I was hit by a car. And I think I fell down the stairs as well. Please. You gotta listen to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Oh, boy. Your shoes might fall off, you bastard.
The first email comes from David in the USA, and he writes a somewhat long preamble to his question, and I'm going to just jump to the question. David writes, my question is this. Might it not be reasonable for a skeptical, rational-thinking individual to turn to an herbal remedy or other medication which has not made it through this rigorous vetting process, and which has only anecdotal or preliminary evidence supporting its use? if they are desperate for some treatment, any treatment, and if evidence-based medicine has nothing to offer them. This is a very good question, one that I am given quite frequently. What do you do if there isn't any scientific proven therapy? Isn't it reasonable to try things that are that for which there is less evidence? You know, of course, that line of reasoning is often used to justify giving alternative treatments, sometimes even very bizarre treatments. You know, the short answer is yes to a degree. And you know what scientific practitioners promote, as I think scientific, ethical, rational medicine, is that first you should always offer the treatment option that has the most evidence for safety and efficacy first. A proven therapy should be preferred above a speculative therapy. But if there is no proven therapy available, or the patient cannot take it for whatever reason, or it's just not an option in the particular case, then it's okay to go down to a treatment for which there is some evidence, even though it's less than definitive. And if there's no treatment in that realm available, then you can go down to a treatment for which there is maybe a minimal evidence, or at the very least, I think that there should be some plausibility. There should be some reason to think that the treatment's a good idea. There is some experience with it. It works for similar things. It's extremely plausible, or all the preliminary evidence is pointing in a positive direction, even though it's still preliminary. The trouble comes when you try to go below that, a treatment for which there is really no compelling evidence and for which there is little or no plausibility, or where there is already evidence for lack of efficacy.
Chelation.
Chelation therapy, it doesn't work. There's enough evidence to show that it does not work. Therefore, that's below the bar of what I consider to be scientific ethical medicine. Homeopathy has zero plausibility.
What if you're thirsty?
The evidence would have to be really incredibly compelling, and what we have is really weak evidence. So you have weak evidence, zero plausibility. That's below the bar.
Steve, so where would somebody, a layman, turn to get to that next layer of possibly somewhat useful or potentially useful therapies?
Well, I still think you should stick with practitioners who have a scientific evidence-based philosophy and who are following that hierarchy of treatments. I think you run into problems when you jump past proven therapies to unproven therapies, when you go below the bar to ones that are implausible or are already proven not to be effective or not to be safe, or when you give experimental therapies but not in the context of proper experimental ethical guidelines. I think if you want the speculative possible treatment, you should first do it in the context of clinical research. And only when that's not available, then take it on what we would consider to be a compassionate basis. And then still you need to do some risk versus benefit, first do no harm type of analysis. You still don't want to harm people out of desperation. That's not good medicine either. So there's a fairly complex clinical thought process you have to go through, but it does include utilizing treatments for which we have less than absolutely perfect evidence. And the challenge for clinicians is making decisions when there isn't sufficient evidence to know for sure what the best thing to do is. And I think this kind of analysis is what we should go through. But just using this to justify nonsensical treatments doesn't make any sense.
Steve, have you ever had a patient that you've had that you didn't have? There was nothing plausible for this person to do?
All the time.
Have you suggested to them that they seek these lesser paths?
I'll give you an example of the kind of analysis that I do with this. I treat patients who have ALS, which is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, better known in the United States as Lou Gehrig's disease. In the UK, it's often referred to as motor neuron disease. This is an incurable, almost always fatal disease. So it's as desperate as you get, right? You're going to die within a couple of years, and there's no cure. That's the situation for most patients. Some patients survive longer, like Stephen Hawking. So there's one proven FDA-approved drug that slows down the progress of the disease. Doesn't cure it, doesn't stop it, but it slows it down. So obviously I offer them that. But then there's a long list of medications or interventions for which there are various degrees of evidence, from animal research to preliminary human research to ones that have some plausibility in terms of their mechanism of action. and maybe some favorable preliminary evidence. And, you know, different neurologists who specialize in ALS will offer different their own sort of cocktail of which experimental therapies they think are above the bar and, you know, not offer or recommend those that are below the bar. And I have my own, you know, and I will offer, and over the years I've offered patients drugs that were available that were probably safe or really known to be safe and for which there was some good reason to think that it was more likely to be helpful than to be harmful. But I haven't offered them or recommended everything that was possibly out there. And then when the evidence comes in that something doesn't work, then I stop it, you know? The other thing I do is that I'm aware of the clinical trials that are going on, and if there's a clinical trial of a certain drug, rather than just give it, my colleagues and I have actually participated in some, you know, clinical trials in ALS. So if we're recruiting for a clinical trial, then obviously we would offer them that, and if we're not, we would let them know that there are other centers that are doing clinical trials and that they could get these one of these experimental agents as part of a clinical trial. That, I think, is the appropriate way to go about it. Proven therapies first, you know, experimental treatments under the guise of an experimental protocol, and then speculative treatments when they're plausible and safe. But not just anything goes, you know, whatever
so
it
no
is.
So no bee venom therapy.
No bee venom, you know, not... There have been some real wacky ones that have come down the line, or just ones that I thought were dangerous, like intrathecal, which means in the CSF sac around the spinal cord, intravenous immune globulin. People want to know if they should fly to China to get stem cells injected in their spinal cord and brain. And I, in the strongest terms possible, suggest that they do not do that, because that's, in my opinion, a fraudulent clinic with no real plausibility.
A little psychic surgery going on there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, somebody asks, should I get this psychic surgery? No, I don't think.
Well, Steve, I agree definitely. You know, there's the big obvious ones not to go at, and don't spend a lot of money. Of course, I wouldn't spend a lot of money on any of these things. I would like to think that if I was in the throes of death, you know, like I'm 6 months away from being pronounced dead, that I wouldn't just throw all of my family's money out the window to pursue some lark.
And it happens, and I see that happen. And, of course, the family's never going to say, don't do this. I mean, they'll spend every dime, you know. And it gets really – it's not just like they're spending their disposable income. They'll, like, take a second mortgage out on their house, sell all their worldly possessions. I mean, the family and the patient will do desperate things sometime, and then they pass away 6 months or a year later, leaving their family not just poor but actually significantly in debt. And, you know, again, you can't really compare money to the value of the life of a loved one. I totally understand that. But when the probability of any benefit that's being offered is insignificant, is so close to zero that it really should be treated as zero, then I think that that's exploitive and just, you know, adding just insult to injury in patients and families who are going through, you know, a hard enough time. The next email, this actually is a question that comes from the Skeptics Guide message board, which was posted by Jan, J-A-A-N, I think that's how it's pronounced, and who wrote, I ran across this interesting article from the UK where it's suggested that walking to the store is worse for the environment than driving. This is a... So we'll link to the article, of course. This is an interesting article. I don't really buy the conclusions of this specific article. I wanted to include it more to talk about this concept. So what they're saying, what the author of this study is saying, is that if you calculate the carbon dioxide and also the methane that's released in the production of the food that it would take to give you the calories that you need to walk to the store, it's actually about four times as much CO2 as would be released by your car and just driving there. This is one of those situations that we get into frequently in these kinds of political scientific arenas. For example, with recycling, we had the same discussion, and also with biofuels. It's when you try to calculate, you know, two situations to see which one is more efficient or better or whatever, and there are so many variables. And there's a lot of discussion back and forth about, well, have you taken into consideration all of the variables, and how did you choose the ones that you used? And oftentimes there's so many choices to be made, there's so much leeway on both sides that you could prove almost any position that you want to. And that's the kind of the discussion about this approach. For example, these calculations were done by Chris Goodall, and he chose for your source of calories beef, which is probably the most inefficient source of calories in terms of CO2 production that you could use. The calculations would certainly be different if it
rice,
were, if you got your calories from carbohydrates or from vegetables or from jelly beans. I don't know, you know, how much CO2 would I produce by eating jelly beans for my calories to get to the store. It's interesting also that Mr. Goodall is the Green Party parliamentary candidate for Oxford West and Abingdon. So obviously he's a politician. And he is trying to basically turn popular, what he calls popular myths, on their head. This is not the first article I've written about this. There are others who have done analysis, for example, saying that Hummers are more environmentally friendly than a Prius. Because if you calculate the environmental impact of manufacturing the batteries and, you know, the toxic elements that go into the batteries and the disposing of it, that actually does more harm to the environment than any extra gas that's burned by the Hummer. But that if
I heard something similar about those light bulbs, the compact fluorescent light bulbs.
They contain a little bit of mercury. That's right.
Yeah, the chemicals inside, if you dispose them, it leaks into the environment and does a lot of damage.
Now, the Hummer Prius thing has been highly criticized because of the way the calculations were done. But what it really highlights is the complexity of trying to figure out the correct answer. You know, whenever when I try to get to the bottom of these things, again, like with the biofuel or the fluorescent light bulbs or whatever, I never seem to get to the point where I find what I consider to be a definitive analysis or answer. There's always one more step you can take. Well, like you consider the gas that's expended in bringing the food to the store or delivering the gas or whatever. I mean, how many different steps back are you going to go? Because obviously, any system like this is such a complex web of interactions. It's probably not possible to calculate the net effect of any one piece that you manipulate, you know?
And is it even worthwhile trying to make the calculation? When I read this, I just felt like, I thought what you were just saying, Steve, like, oh my God, there's a lot of layers. There's so many layers. It just keeps going back and back. Why not just stick to the things that can be changed? We're not going to stop producing beef. We're not going to stop trucking. Without trucking, the entire world would stop. You know, like,
yeah, right. But realizing that it has an effect, an important effect, you know, maybe we could start thinking of alternate ways to do things to ameliorate that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the other lesson in this, is that if we do simplistic things and assume that they're going to be beneficial, they may not be, you know, because there may be some unanticipated consequences that actually more than offset whatever benefit we think that we're generating.
But this article smacks of fear tactics, you know?
Yeah, I think is more of a stunt. I don't think that it was really done terribly objectively or very scholarly. You know, this guy is anti-cattle farming, so he has some, you know, preconceived political opinions that are in line with this analysis that he did.
This article reminds me of something I heard on NPR a few weeks ago. They were talking about how damaging bottled water is to the environment. For a few points they brought up, I thought that this sounded very valid. One is water is very, very heavy, and it's terribly difficult and expensive to truck water, you know, compared to other food items or other perishable items. The other thing I thought was interesting, in the United States in particular, that the fresh water systems that the cities have and that all the local towns have and everything is actually very, very good. The quality of our water is very, very good.
Yeah.
It's a complete and total waste to be buying, you know, your primary source of water from bottled water, from all that processed, you know, plastic that goes into it, and, you know,
bottled water is terribly inefficient. It's also a ripoff.
It's just tap water.
It's a ripoff.
I mean, how many exposés do you have to see where they do taste tests and the tap water from the back kitchen is seen as just as good as Evian or something? I mean, it happens all the time.
Bottled water is completely convenient. There's nothing about it other than you could just pick one up and run with it or take it with you wherever you're going.
Well, I mean, you can just get a water bottle and fill it up at home and take it with you and just clean it. you know, and it's actually it's not just that the it's not just the plastic. It actually takes a lot of water in just in the process. And I think that the ratio I saw was 3 to 1. It takes about 3 times as much water to make put the water in that bottle. You know,
Jay, I think they should just ship dehydrated water.
Just dead water. One more news item. This one is a follow-up to last week. This one's by Kyle Cook of Bowling Green, and he writes, "As always, thanks for providing an excellent podcast to start my week off just right. However, last week I did find one thing to gripe about a bit. One of my favorite segments is the science or fiction portion, and while I am definitely not always right, I generally understand the correct answer. However, last week, even after learning the true stories, I did not feel that the AI... that's artificial intelligence, with a sense of humor should be classified as science. To me, sense of humor describes something more than just the way something is delivered. If I am understanding correctly, this program detects variations in the voice that are commonly associated with telling a joke, much the same way a lie detector tries to determine truth through bio patterns. Perhaps a joke-detecting AI was made, but just as sweaty palms don't constitute a lie, the right inflections in the voice don't always make it humor. Unfortunately, I think we still only have data, able to understand that a joke has been told, yet unable to find the humor in it. Hence, in my view, data had no sense of humor. Maybe I'm way off base here, but I'm sure you'll let me know if I am. Anyways, keep the great work coming."
Well, I can answer this. No, you're not way off base. You're right. I was right. And I should get credit for being correct on this week's science or fiction. Thank you. Next question.
You're wrong, Evan. Listen, with the
Kyle doesn't think
the
so.
Science
Steve.
Or fiction? Obviously, when I state the items, I don't always give all the information. You know, in order to make it a little bit more challenging, I may omit some pieces of information, or I may describe things in a way that is a little bit misleading. That's part of the, again, it's a game, it's for fun, that's part of the challenge.
Right.
It's just an interesting way to talk about some recent news items. Oftentimes, I'll hide behind the way the researchers describe their own research or the way the way it was being presented.
Which is exactly what you did.
Which is what I did in this case. I mean, and I don't, you know, want to, I stop short of being what I feel is completely misleading or erroneous. But I do take a little bit of license or a little bit of liberty to make things more interesting. And in this case, you know, I don't think that anyone thought that what was being claimed was a self-aware artificial intelligence. We're so obviously far away from that. I mean, that wasn't the implication. The term having a sense of humor was used to mean ability to detect jokes, not
right.
experiencing humor as a truly artificially intelligent emotional being did. I mean, that obviously that wasn't what was being implied.
Bob, Steve doesn't need your help. He's explaining things.
Bob agrees with me.
Evan, if you did your research, you would have come across that article, and like I did, you would have realized.
You're saying if I Googled it while he was asking the questions and came up with
that? Beforehand.
Yeah, that's exactly what you're saying.
The thing I thought about.
We all know. We all know. Come on. You sit
there. Don't even joke about that, dude, because I take that very seriously.
Okay, I was joking about that. I retract that, Bob.
And to be clear, you know, Kyle is incorrect in his characterization of the study. It wasn't that it was detecting inflections in voices. It wasn't like a lie detector system. It was analyzing the language of the jokes and detecting the puns that were in there.
I understand where he's coming from, though. I mean, if I was a listener to this show and I was playing the science, you know, the science or fiction game, I would be a little put off by that, especially if I got it wrong because of how obscure that was.
I understand, and I understand that sometimes mm-hmm. I skate close to the edge. I do understand that. In order to, you know, get interesting items or make items interesting and challenging. But first of all, there's nothing at stake, right? So it's not a question of fair. It's
well, I wouldn't say nothing at stake.
There's pride. There's ego. There's lots of things.
As I said, nothing
here.
At stake.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I feel like the bottom line is it's a game. Who cares? It's for fun.
Right. And Steve, that's how the researchers put it.
Yeah, those were my words. Those were not my words. If I do take liberty, I will usually use the researchers' words, not my own. Every now and then, everyone has felt cheated at some point by a misleading science or fiction item, which is why I thought it'd be fun to talk about it. And
agreed. And I'm just having fun with
it,
too.
And I know, and I acknowledge it that, you know, sometimes I do play, you know, take a little liberty with it. But that, again, it's just for fun. We don't have a guest this week, so I'm going to do a name that logical fallacy. Oh, this should be a quick one. This comes from the boards as well. And here is the statement. Say I am arguing against someone about fossil fuel usage. I state...
You are arguing against someone about fossil fuel usage. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. That wasn't an instruction. You were...
I'm quoting.
Sorry.
I state that the average American should drive a fuel-efficient vehicle to lower the amount of fuel that is used. The person I am arguing against then tells me that since I drive a car that is not fuel-efficient, I cannot expect and tell others to drive different vehicles. So the poster wants to know what logical fallacy this is.
Oh, ad hominem tu quoque.
Yeah, it's a tu quoque logical fallacy, that which means you too, or which is a fallacy of saying that it's, you know, two wrongs make a right, or that if it's okay if person A is wrong because person B is wrong too. Which of course is does not logically follow. If something's wrong, it's wrong. It's not made right because somebody else does it. So the point here is, I may be driving a fuel inefficient car, but that doesn't mean it's okay to do it. You know, I'm not the de facto standard. That in fact, it still is a good idea to drive more fuel efficient cars. We're just assuming that as the premise of the question. You know, rather than questioning that. Although in this particular example, I do think that there could be a more subtle point in here, in that it's not a question of what people should do, but rather, is it feasible for people to drive hyper, you know, fuel efficient cars? You don't do it yourself. You could argue that the real point is that the arguer is saying it's not really convenient or feasible. And that you can't maintain that it is when you're not doing it yourself. That point has actually come up quite a bit in the campaign, because some of the candidates who may be promoting a very green message are then flying around in, you know, private jets, or taking, you know, large convoys of vehicles, you know, to events.
Well, that kind of kills the argument almost, though. If this is the way things should be done, but it's not practical to do it that way, then it's hard to support the argument that that's what you should be doing, unless you make these grandiose changes to the infrastructure.
Right, and that's why I said it depends on whether or not there's even a logical fallacy depends on what the point is.
Right.
If the point is it's a good thing to do, then it's a logical fallacy. Well, you're not doing it. But if the point is it's not practical, then it's actually a reasonable counter argument to say.
Right.
You know,
okay.
Well, if it's impractical for you, then it's unreasonable for you to expect that it should be practical for other people, because that's the logical fallacy of inconsistency, of selectively using arguments in different situations. You know.
So it might be hypocritical, but not necessarily illogical.
Right.
And now, Randy speaks.
Randy, you have had some experience examining acupuncture in China. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I've not inspected it from the direction of being the recipient of the needles, I'm happy to report. But when I've been to China several times now, I don't remember exactly which trip this was on, but at my own request, I asked to see the acupuncture clinic that they had nearby. We were at the I think it's called the Beijing Mind Brain Institute, if I recall correctly. There was a room full of people, most of them undergoing moxibustion, which is rather longer needles than acupuncture. They're sometimes as much as a foot long, and they're inserted into the arms and the shoulders and the chest and whatnot. And they have on the end of them a little platform about the size of a dime of very, very light metal. And a bit of punk, some sort of incense, is placed on the end of it and ignited. They look a little bit like bizarre Christmas trees, though I can't say that I've ever seen a Christmas tree that quite looked like a moxibustion patient. The rooms are all filled with the smell of the incense, and the attendants go around regularly. The idea of moxibustion is that the heat from the burning incense or punk or whatever it is on the end of the little platform is supposed to be transmitted down the narrow wire. Now, of course, it's dissipated before it gets anywhere near the body, so there's no transmission of that kind at all. But after all, it's magic, so I guess we have to accept those rules. And when I was speaking to a couple of the elderly gentlemen, they're both of them educated, one of them at MIT and the other fellow someplace in California. I've forgotten at what center, but they were both very fluent in English. And they both told me in so many words, oh, no, we don't believe in oxybustion, but the patient should receive some relief from it. And it's probably psychological, but we never treat people who really have serious diseases that can be treated by pharmaceuticals and or by surgery. But a lot of people come in here and they just want some comfort. They just want a bit of relief and they have some discomfort. And we will often allow the moxibustionist to move in. And they told me that the people practicing the moxibustion were probably of different opinion. They probably believed that it worked, but they certainly didn't believe that it worked. And this is part of the problem in China because they just have such a huge populace and so many ill people or people who believe that they're ill or people that need some sort of comfort and attention and TLC, that this is one of the ways that they administer the TLC. And I thought that was not a bad system, frankly, as long as they have real physicians, and these people were real physicians who could find out whether or not they really, the patients really needed some sort of medical help. I can't object to that. It's a bit of comfort that is brought to these people, and they seem to be relatively satisfied with it. So the acupuncture experience, just seeing these people all sitting around smoking, well, smoking because they had incense burning on them, was most interesting, I must say, and gave me a bit of an insight into, A, into Chinese medicine, and B, into Chinese psychology, I guess.
Did you find that the scientists who had admitted to they did not believe that it actually worked, were they disingenuous with the patients? Did they try to convince the patients that this was effective?
Well, it's hard to say, because the attitude that that any teacher has, as in Japan as well, a sensei instructor in Japan has no patience with students at all. Their students don't ask questions. They are just told. They're just told, sit, stand, go over there, give me your arm. It's not, that doesn't seem to be a doctor-patient relationship as we would like to understand it. They are very officious, and they just tell the patient what's going to happen. They don't take any arguments, and they don't ask anybody's permission. So it was very hard for me to tell. It was all very laconic. That it's a different psychological approach. The master, after all, the teacher is the one who does the declarations and the statements, and the patient is just the subject for it. So again, that was hard for me to analyze and to interpret.
Randy, thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you all can play along. We have a theme this week. I know how you love themes. The theme is nutrition.
Yum.
Cool.
Wait, let me open up Google. Okay, go.
You better not be Googling.
Bob, don't take my insult personally.
I'm not. I just want to make it clear that
Item number one. New study shows that drinking milk after weightlifting led to more fat loss and greater muscle gain than drinking soy or a carbohydrate drink. Item number two. New study suggests that the elderly should be eating more vegetables and less meat in order to maintain their muscle mass. And item number three, a new animal study suggests that low-calorie or diet foods and drinks may lead to obesity. Bob, go first.
All of these are true. All right. Number one, drinking milk after weightlifting led to more fat loss and greater muscle gain than drinking soy or carbohydrate. That's true. New study suggests that elderly should be eating more vegetables and less meat. Oh, in order to maintain, that makes no sense. You'd think you'd want more meat, more protein in order to maintain muscle mass. Item three, low-calorie diet foods and drinks may lead to obesity. I'm going to say that's true. So I'm going to say that the elderly eating less meat to maintain muscle mass is fiction.
Okay. Evan?
I agree with Bob.
All right, Jay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I just got lost in thought. It was unfamiliar territory, but low-calorie diet foods and drinks may lead to obesity. I think I'll go with the elderly eating vegetables.
Okay. So you all think that the elderly eating vegetables and less meat in order to maintain muscle mass is the fake, which means you all think that item number one, new study shows that drinking milk after weightlifting led to more fat loss and greater muscle gain than drinking soy or a carbohydrate drink. And that is science.
Now, this was skim milk, though. That's an important distinction, right, Steve?
Yeah, in this study, that the milk was skim milk, so it actually was not a lot of fat. This was a study published today, actually, in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It was conducted by the Department of Kinesiology's Exercise Metabolism Research Group, led by Stuart Phillips, and they had three groups. They all engaged in weightlifting exercise. One group drank 2 cups of skim milk after working out. One drank soy beverage, and the third, a carbohydrate beverage with an equivalent amount of energy, which is typically drinking a sports drink. And what they found was the skim milk group lost the most weight and gained the most muscle. The soy group actually lost no fat, and the carbohydrate drink was somewhere in between. So this adds to previous research, they say. Phillips was quoted as saying, "I think the evidence is beginning to mount. Milk may be best known for its calcium content in supporting bone health, but our research and that of others continually supports milk's ability to aid in muscle growth and also promote body fat loss."
Wow.
So milk does a body good, I guess, is the bottom line of their research. The research is mixed in terms of the overall health effects of milk. It clearly is very nutritious. You know, it has a lot of fats, proteins, and calories in it that our
and
body
kids
needs.
Need it, don't they? I mean, it's good for children.
Oh yeah, yeah.
To have as part of their diet.
But the question is for adults. You know, is the is how bad is milk fat, and overall, what's the health effects of milk? But I think that the scaremongering that some of the anti-milk activists have out there is not really based on science. That the research depends on what you look at, but there's. In terms of how nutritious it is, the research is moving in the direction of, it's actually pretty good. You all also agreed that a new animal study suggests that low-calorie or diet foods and drinks may lead to obesity is true, and that one is science.
Yay.
You guys all got it right this week.
Yeah, guys.
I got scared that you made a subtle tweak, like it wasn't an animal study.
That last
study.
One, yeah.
Like it wasn't an animal study. It was actually done on kids, and I don't remember that from reading the article.
Although
I
haven't done that kind of nonsensical tweak. I usually change the actual bottom line of the study.
That's true.
But this one is science, as I stated, and this was a study on rats, not on people. But what they showed is that when they substitute low calorie food, that the rats will then begin overeating and they'll gain weight because they start overeating. So this is not to imply that reducing calories makes the animals overweight. It's that giving them diet food makes them overeat. They eat more calories and then get obese. Now, what they think may be going on, and they say this may also help explain the quote-unquote puzzling results from other studies, where, again, in the introduction of low-calorie or diet foods, you know, it may lead to, in fact, a greater consumption and more weight gain. The speculation is, and clearly there needs to be some follow-up research to sort this out, is that as we grow up, we develop a sense of how much calories we're getting in the food that we eat. And if you feed children sweet-tasting food that doesn't have any calories, then their body learns that they can consume a lot of food that tastes like that without getting a lot of calories, and that leads to overeating. Because then they'll eat other foods that are also, you know, just as sweet or pleasurable or whatever, but are loaded with calories. But their bodies don't realize it. Their bodies are teaching their bodies a distorted view of how much calories their food has, and that leads to overeating.
Huh. Steve, I read something that said that because if you're not eating the real thing, you know, your body knows the difference. Your taste might not know the difference, but your body does register the calories and whatnot. You don't get sated from like a diet soda like you would from a caloric soda.
If that were true, though, then it would just be a neutral thing, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're not getting the calories and your body doesn't think it's getting the calories, so it wouldn't right? That wouldn't necessarily make you overeat. But this is saying...
like you're training yourself to not recognize...
Yeah, so you'll eat food that has the calories and you think you're not getting it because you've been trained by the diet, you know, food and drink, that there isn't this association of calories with stuff that tastes this way. It's kind of speculative. It's an interesting concept. It needs to be further researched, but it is a hypothesis that explains this research.
It sounds to me like the lights are on but nobody's home kind of explanation. Like, really? Would people really think, oh, I'm drinking a diet soda. Okay, now I'm going to go to Dunkin' Donuts and have a donut. And they're going to screw that up? Like,
well, it's subconscious, Jay. What they're saying is that we subconsciously develop this gestalt sense of how much calories we've eaten based upon what the food tastes like.
So it's psychological, not chemical. There's not a chemical reaction going on telling your body's right. Telling you.
Right.
I would say it's neurological, not psychological. It's you know, your brain.
What's the difference?
It's like a feedback loop. It's like your brain is learning. I need to the eating center of the brain, the part of the brain that is telling you whether or not you should be hungry or not. It uses a lot of cues, you know, how full your stomach feels and how much energy you have, etc. And there's also hormonal things that will affect, you know, how much hunger you have. So I guess what they're saying is that how hungry you feel is also influenced by how many calories you've estimated that you've eaten, again, subconsciously. This is not a conscious thing.
Another interesting thing. How
the food that you have eaten has tasted.
That means you can conceivably train people who fall into that trap to learn better eating habits, or...
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting concept. I mean, I guess you can use it, exploit it, maybe, to train people to eat fewer calories. I don't know.
Very interesting.
But, Steve, why the article I read applied this to children, specifically mentioning...
Because they think that you learn these things as a child.
Oh.
You know, when you're an adult, maybe your set point is already there. Maybe, I don't, okay. You know, and I don't know that they have a real basis for that either, except just assuming that it's something that's more, that it happens.
Do you ever think about how much you would eat if you could just eat as much and as frequently as you wanted to?
I think we would slowly
morph into a world or whoever could afford to eat this much. But like, I would pile away, you know, a gallon of ice cream a night.
Fetch me a bucket.
You know, I think that's this might seem a little out there. I think that's a possibility at some indefinite time in the future. Imagine, like sex, we've divorced the pleasure of sex from the procreation aspect of it. Just through
birth control
and other methods. I wonder if we'll do the same thing with food, where we'll get to the point where we can somehow have the human body get the precise nutrition it needs throughout the day through some sort of, I don't know, some sort of implant or
Soylent
something,
or...
and then actually make eating food be purely for the pleasure of it.
So you're saying eating becomes a leisure activity?
Yeah, which it kind of is now. You know, to a degree, people eat for pleasure, certainly. Go to a restaurant, you know, have a gourmet meal. It's not just for the nutrition. It's for the experience. But, you know, what Bob is saying, the technology may get to the point where it's 100% for the pleasure because you can get your nutrition some other way. Or another scenario, Bob, might be that, let's say your meals are prepared by a food synthesizer, which is controlled by your home computer, you know, whatever, just to give an example. And it precisely gives you the calories and nutrition that you need in a day, and it could put that in any amount of food that you want to eat.
Yeah, or form or whatever, make it seem like eating chocolate, maybe.
Yeah, it's doling out your calories and nutrition as much as you need.
But
you still can eat as much food as you want. It'll space out the calories.
So guys, what would it be for you? Let's say we can turn that switch on right now. What would you go for?
Peanut butter and chocolate all day. And lasagna.
Evan?
What do they call it? Alfredo, like, you know, that really bad cream.
Fettuccine Alfredo.
Yeah, cheese and cream.
That's good stuff.
Alfredo,
you get a good puke on if you eat too much of that, boy.
Oh, man, I tell you.
Go ahead, Steve.
I like my favorite dessert, I think, is... the white chocolate raspberry cheesecake from the Cheesecake Factory.
Oh, yeah.
That's good stuff.
That's decadent.
Their banana cheesecake is really good, too.
We should get them to sponsor our podcast. That rule. They can send us samples and stuff, and we can talk about it.
We could all gain tons of weight.
No one will know. It's not a video podcast.
Well, if you were to say to Jay, hey, Jay, what would you eat? You know,
Jay, like, we have to ask?
I've never in my life sat down and ate as much ice cream as I ever wanted to. I think I would just want to go for broke on, say, cookies and cream or something like that. That'd be fun. But, I mean, I would join Bob as well. I think I would want to take a bath in peanut butter.
How about meatballs, Jay? I thought you would want an orgy on meatballs.
I've done that.
Careful. Careful.
Remember the story,
Bob? Remember. I remember.
All of this means, of course, that number two, new study suggests that the elderly should eat more vegetables and less meat in order to maintain their muscle mass is fiction.
Pure hucklebuck.
It is pure hucklebuck. And I did not just tweak it, I reversed it like I usually do. I made the conclusion very different than the real conclusion. In fact, what the study suggests is that the elderly need to eat more meat. They need to consume more protein.
That was a little easy, though, Steve.
Yeah, well, I was hoping, you know, sometimes you guys choose the obvious ones, or you think the obvious ones might be.
Oh.
I got to mix it up. I can't. Yeah.
Steve, does it particularly please you when we just totally guff a really easy one?
He sleeps well those nights.
It derives no secret twisted pleasure out of it.
I prefer it when you guys are all over the board. That means I balanced them well.
Yeah. You're too except scientific about one, everything. Okay.
There's a certain abstract intellectual pleasure.
Yeah.
In a well-crafted fake.
Steve gets a Woody.
Yeah.
The study basically says that the elderly don't eat as much meat as younger adults. It could be a variety of reasons. You know, meat's more expensive.
Tougher to chew.
They may not have as much of an appetite. It's tougher to consume. And the elderly do have less body mass, less lean muscle tissue than younger adults. And the study showed that by consuming more high-quality protein, and beef meat has a lot of high-quality protein, that would actually help, you know, make up some of the difference, that it would help their overall muscle mass. So you guys all got that one correct. Congratulations.
Yay, good for us guys.
Evan.
Hi.
It's puzzle time.
Last week's puzzle was as such. What do you call a snake handler who appears between a stinger and a shooter? And the correct answer is, I want to make sure I pronounce this correctly, Ophiuchus.
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 I want to make sure I pronounce this correctly. Ophiuchus.
Ophiuchus. Actually, that Ophiuchus is the pronunciation they're giving at dictionary.com.
Really? Not Ophiuchus?
No. Ophiu. Wow. And the U is the dominant syllable.
Because then my semi-penultimate syllable rule doesn't hold. Actually, somebody on the board said it's actually anti-penultimate, not semi-penultimate.
I've heard.
And anti-penultimate is, of course, correct, but semi-penultimate is widely used. And I was able to find multiple instances of it being used to mean the same thing, the third from the last, anti-penultimate or semi-penultimate. So it's one of those things. Are you a purist, or do you think that usage is enough to establish something as legitimate? I used semi-penultimate because that's how I heard it in the exact same context of where to put the accent. So that's why I used that.
Now, how does this tie into a skeptical podcast, you might be thinking? Well,
yeah, where's the skeptical angle, Evan?
This is the 13th constellation along the famous zodiac.
Yes.
It is the unspoken 13th constellation that is within the zodiac band that I guess astrologers gloss over.
Well, they gloss over it because actually it wasn't a legitimate sign when astrology was created, you know, many centuries ago. But now, because of stellar drift, bam, we've got a 13th now. And of course, they don't take that into account because they don't change their so-called science, quote unquote. So so when people ask me what my sign is, I say Ophiuchus.
I say Ophiuchus.
The Wikipedia entry has Ophiuchus, and that's how I've always heard it, which is an argument from authority, but who cares?
All right, well,
but who cares? So
we'll get back to that. So there you go.
Evan, you can't argue with Wikipedia. Come on.
That's another story altogether.
Who won, Evan?
Our good friend, Cap Sponge, was the first one to answer it correctly.
You have a bit of a longer puzzle for us this week.
I have a poem this week.
A poem. Are you going to read it in iambic pentameter?
Read that poem.
Whameter.
Read that poem.
Here comes the poem. I sure hate this delusional person, though hate may be a word too strong. As I learn more, my opinion does worsen. Perhaps I won't rewrite this song. Microset scams were just some of his wares. He claims he is spiritual at heart. A dozen or so of these blessings are shared. Jesus could only hope to master their art. From his website I read, as they humbly plead, that they can lay hands and cure you of ills. Just join them and pray, for you will see one day you've found their holy mountains and hills. For it was their king that taught them these things. They are simply swine to this pearl thrower. A doctor, a reverend, a knight, so he sings. But it was yoga that made him a knower. Name this person.
That was your best poem so far, Evan.
Thanks. Good luck, everyone.
Evan, I have a new riddle task for you.
Okay.
You have to come up with a puzzle that is written as a limerick in order... This is paying homage, of course, to Christopher Hitchens.
Christopher Hitchens.
Who regaled us with quite a number of limericks when we interviewed him.
I accept your challenge, Dr. Novo.
Okay. Limerick puzzle.
But don't make it an obscene limerick like he does.
Obscene limerick. Gotcha, Bob. You got
okay,
it.
Okay, good.
So Perry, once again, is joining us from his sickbed at Yale New Haven Hospital, where he is recovering, to give us the quote of the week. Perry, how are you feeling?
Hey, I'm all right, everybody. But I'll tell you in a second. First, my skeptical duty, this week's quote of some note. To believe with certainty, we must begin with doubting. That was Stanislaus the First, 1677 to 1766, a Polish king of some note. How is everybody tonight?
Great. Good, Perry. How are you doing?
I'm all right, you know. It's now obvious that I'm going to be missing the August 11th fest this weekend, which is, you know, which I'm upset about. I was looking forward to being there. You know, I wanted to meet a lot of these, our audience members for the first time. And I think it surprised a lot of our audience members to realize I never met Rebecca face to face. And I was actually looking forward to doing that.
We miss you, buddy. Come on. We need you to come back.
I'll be back very soon, and I'll get back on the show with my skeptical droopies.
Thank you, Perry.
Yeah. Okay. All right, everybody. I'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
Love you, Perry.
Good night, buddy.
Perry DeAngelis, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, Perry certainly is a trooper. Still give us the quote of the week, even from his hospital bed, and certainly hope he gets better soon. He can rejoin us. He will not be at the August 11th live recording of our show this weekend. But hopefully he'll be back on the next show. Well, thank you all again.
Thank you, Steve. It was a great night.
Good episode.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.